All right, we have one case on our docket for argument this morning. And Mr. Jensen is the sole attorney who will be arguing today. Mr. Steimel, who is the counsel of record on appeal for the mother, is ill. And Mr. Ty, who is counsel for the Texas Department of Family and Protective Services, has not shown today, has not appeared, and has not sent in any written explanation of why he is not here. So we have told Mr. Jensen that he will have his 15 minutes and his 5 minutes in rebuttal to use however he likes, and the court does have some questions, so I'm sure the argument will be very productive. With that, our clerk will call the first case.
The court will now call in the interest of A. W. Attack. You may please report Mr. Terry Jensen to argue for the appellant.
May it please court. My name is Kerry Jensen. I represent the father and W on appeal. As you know, this is a child termination case, and I think the real issue here is this new law, this 101D. The issue is, first of all, does it apply here? And then secondly, if it applies, what standard should be used? Because it is a brand new law. And then there's also a little bit in there about whether it's burden shifting or not, and whether that runs afoul of the federal constitution. So first of all, the question of whether it should apply. Appellee raised the point that it only applies to cases filed on or after September 1st, 2017. And I did review the legislative materials. That is true. However, because this is a direct appeal case, I would say that he waived that argument. The trial court at the lower level applied the new law. The department prepared the order applying the new law, and there was no objection made. Now, in preparation for oral argument, I did look at, try to find some few cases that were kind of on point with the waiver argument. I did find an unpublished case out of Austin for 1998. It's in re Spepnek, 1998, Westlaw 717202.
How do you spell Spepnek?
I'm sorry?
How do you spell Spepnek?
Spepnek is spelled S-P-E-P-N-E-K. Okay. And in this case, it was the same type of deal. There were several plaintiffs, some filed before the effective date, some filed after. The appellee argued that the wrong law was applied. And, of course, the appellant then says, well, you waived that argument. However, the difference between that case and this case is that case was an original proceeding. Now, in that case, they kind of hinted that if this was a direct appeal, then maybe that argument would hold water. But because it is an original proceeding, it doesn't actually need to be preserved for us to hear it. And they found that the court did abuse its discretion in not applying the correct law based on the effective date.
So in the trial court, what discussion was had about this new law from the department's standpoint?
In this case or in the case I'm describing?
I'm sorry, in your case.
In my case, there was no discussion at all. Not that I could find on the record. The trial court submitted the findings of facts and conclusion of law. In both the findings of fact and the conclusions of law, he tracked the new law language exactly. There was no doubt that he applied the new law. In that findings of fact and conclusions of law, he ordered the department to draft the order. The department drafted the order using that exact same language, tracking the exact same language in the law. So, I mean, there is no doubt that the trial court in this case applied the new law.
So you're saying that even if the legislature says this law is not going to take effect until X time, that a party can override that effective date by waiver?
I am not saying that. I'm not saying that the court applied the, in response to the appellee's brief, I can't tell you that the court applied the correct law and that waiver was proper in this place, in this case. I'm not saying that you can waive it at the lower court. I am just saying that because it was not objected to at court. Rule 33 doesn't allow you to hear that argument on appeal.
Well, let's say that we find your argument concerning this new law persuasive on the merits, and because you're complaining about that finding of fact and conclusion of law, are you not?
I am complaining about it as it applies to the new law. I do
either one that it was it would the evidence doesn't support
the
what he found, i.e., that there he found that there was not a good faith basis excusing the failure to comply with the order, and you're challenging that.
Okay? I am challenging that.
So even if we were to find that you're correct that the evidence doesn't support the finding, and we were to reverse on that basis, how are we to send it back and say that it continues to apply on retrial? In other words, the preservation of error argument that you're making, i.e., that it was not preserved, effectively becomes law of the case, and that a law that actually the legislature didn't say would apply now becomes applicable on remand?
Well,
so you kind of see where I'm going here.
I do see where you're going.
Okay.
With that. And if you were to send it back based on an insufficiency of evidence, I don't see why there would be a retrial because you found that no fact finder could find based on that. So, but I do see where you're coming from, and I don't really have an answer for that.
Okay.
But if it does apply. Do you have any more questions about whether or not it should apply? I would like to move on to if it applies, what standard should be used.
Sure.
Okay. Right now, as worded, it's the department's job to prove that they didn't follow the service plan beyond a reasonable doubt. I'm sorry, clear and convincing evidence. And then the statute puts in there that it is then the defendant's job to prove beyond a preponderance of the evidence that they had basically had good cause. Now, the problem with this is that the standard of review, the clear and convincing standard, is set forth by the U.S. Constitution, and the U.S. Supreme Court has says that the state courts must use at least a clear and convincing standard. The problem is when you use burden shifting, it makes it less than that standard, and the Texas Supreme Court has addressed that in INRI LMI. That's a Texas 199 Southwest 3rd 707. This had to do with it. This was a voluntary relinquishment case. The courts were split in that case. What was happening was that the state was proving that there was a relinquishment by clear and convincing evidence. And then some courts were saying it's then the defendant's job to prove by a preponderance that that it wasn't coerced or under duress or whatnot, or that it was, I'm sorry. And then some other courts are saying, well, because of that clear and convincing standard, you can't shift the burden to the defendant because that's the minimum. It makes it harder for the defendant than clear and convincing. So, and of course, the Fort Worth court ultimately sided with the latter, and then it went up to the Texas Supreme Court, and the Texas Supreme Court agreed. They said, you can't shift the burden to defendant. It is the department's burden to prove by clear and convincing evidence that that it wasn't under duress and that it wasn't coerced. And this is kind of the same thing that we see here. The legislature has tried to shift the burden to the defendant in what should be a minimum clear and convincing standard. So it actually makes it harder for the defendant than the clear and convincing standard that is required of termination cases. And so that's why in my brief, I briefed on it should be the department's job to prove by clear and convincing evidence that the defendant didn't have a reasonable excuse by a preponderance. And I know that's kind of backwards, and it's but when you look at legislative intent, you have to assume that the legislature did not try to run afoul of the federal constitution, and that is just one way that I see to kind of reconcile this law.
Now, is that an issue that you think that we can get to if we rule that 001D doesn't apply here?
I don't. If you believe that 001D doesn't apply here, I think it's a pretty clear abuse of discretion in this case, and it would have to be remanded for either a new trial or new findings of fact. I would argue a new trial because it seemed like everyone at the trial level, which I unfortunately was not a part of, ran their trial with the intention of applying this new standard. And so I think it's only fair to the defendant that he get a new trial. I'm sorry, to the respondent that he get a new trial to apply the correct standard. So, but that's basically where we're at now, is should it apply? If it doesn't apply, then the trial court abused its discretion. I really have no counter argument for that. The statutory deadline.
So tell me how, if it does apply, tell me how it should be applied at the trial level in terms of what's the argument in the, how does this, the state obviously maintains, even under this scenario, the absolute burden of clear and convincing.
Right.
But the legislature has created a defense with a lesser burden of proof on it, where the respondent can take a chunk out of the clear and convincing. So is it burden shift all the time in summary judgment context? If I meet the burden on preponderance, that shifts the, even in a summary judgment context, it shifts the burden over to the non-movement to raise a fact issue at that point in time.
Right.
So here, if the state puts on clear and convincing evidence that an order was not complied with,
right,
then there, as it stands right now, case over. There's not even an opportunity for the respondent to say, well, gee, there was a good reason why I didn't get that done.
Right.
Okay. There's no excuse defense as it stands now. So as long as the state is putting on clear and convincing evidence that the order was not complied with, then why do you think there's a harm in creating a method by which that can be excused? Because usually you've either complied with the court's order or you haven't. That's usually not there's no real gray area on those kinds of things.
And I think that's why the legislature acted on this, is because it was too much of a black and white line there. If you miss one therapy appointment, then there's clear and convincing evidence that you didn't do that. And so they added this. It's just from the cases I'm reading, shifting the burden to the defendant does make it harder for the defendant, even if it is an escape kind of clause. I mean,
well, if you've missed your one,
yeah,
if you've missed your one deal, mm-hmm, under the old law, you're done.
I'd agree with that, yes.
You're done. Okay. So you've given the respondent an opportunity, at least for some type of good faith argument, that the strict application of the violation of the order provision shouldn't apply under the circumstances.
Right, but the Supreme Court says that it has to be a clear and convincing standard, and even though it does make it easier, it's along the same lines as the defendant just presenting his own evidence to refute anything that the department has said. The burden really should, in child termination cases, should stay with the department, according to the U.S. Supreme Court. It should stay clear and convincing to the department. And so really this new law should be interpreted as a way that the defendant may present evidence and that evidence may be used.
So essentially you're arguing that it's the burden of proof that's the problem, that really all the legislature should have said is that in considering whether or not an order has been violated, the trial court must take into consideration whether or not there was a good faith effort.
Correct. That is what I'm saying. And then you also have the problem of, what standard do you apply on appeal?
So
should you hold the standard hold them to a standard and then hold the defense to a standard as well, a different standard, and how does that connect with the first standard? It just makes things a lot more complicated as well.
Well, so in an ideal world, are you suggesting that if the legislature were going to amend this statute, that the correct way to do it in keeping with the burden that is on the department, that it should have been, the department has to prove by clear and convincing evidence that services weren't complied with, and they also have to show, the department has to show by clear and convincing evidence that the respondent can't show good faith?
Yes, and that's exactly what I'm saying. And that, to go back to Justice Birdwell's question, the requiring the department to prove the negative by clear and convincing is a harder burden than the defendant trying to prove it by a preponderance. And that is what is required of the federal Constitution, according to the U.S. Supreme Court. I believe the case is Stantosky versus Kramer. I'm sorry, I don't have the site number. But, you know, the Texas Supreme Court in re-LMI just flat out said that, you know, it's a minimum clear and convincing standard that has to apply to the department using, you know, and they cited Stantosky. They said that the U.S. Supreme Court requires the burden to be clear and convincing on the department for there to be a termination. And while it's good that they lessened that burden by allowing the department, the defendant, the respondent, to produce evidence to show that, you know, he had a good reason why he didn't do it, that is still not as high as the Constitution requires. The Constitution requires the department to prove that there wasn't a good reason beyond a reasonable doubt. And they can do that just by saying, he didn't do it. If he doesn't say anything, that's good enough. But, and that would be clear and convincing because it's the only evidence available.
Is this a constitutional challenge to the statute that was made in the trial court or should have been made in the trial court?
Unfortunately, I did not make that challenge.
You were not in the trial court, so.
I was not in the trial
right.
court, yeah.
So, is it something we can reach?
You can interpret the law, but as far as striking down the constitutionality of it, unfortunately, the waiver arguments is a double-edged sword, and that argument was not made in trial court.
Well, do you think it is a constitutional challenge to the statute?
In preparing for this, I do believe that it could be, yes. In preparing for this oral argument. If the court can't reach it today, I may decide to try it next time.
See you again, huh?
Yeah.
In a case filed after September 1, 2017.
Yeah. Well, if there are no other questions, I'll give you back some time.
Questions? Any other questions?
No. Thank you, counsel.
Yeah. Thank you so much. Your case is submitted. We appreciate you driving down from Wichita Falls and presenting your arguments and answering our questions, and we'll hear from us shortly.
All right.
Thank you. The clerk will adjourn court.
All rise. The Honorable Court of Appeals of the Second District of Texas now stands adjourned.